Well, hello everyone. Past couple of weeks, I have spent quite a bit of time looking at all of the ways in which culture, American culture, has been top down. And things that seem spontaneous and bottom up are, in fact, the plans being executed of an organized minority. Well, in this video, I've got pretty much the smoking gun that proves everything I've been saying for years with receipts. I was kind of mind blown when this came across my desk, because a buddy of mine said, hey, you've got to take a look at this book. All that stuff you were saying about BLM being astroturfed and actually being the foot soldiers of the regime, Greta Thunberg's all the way down. Remember all those catchphrases? If you're pushing at an open door, you are not a radical. Well, this book right here, America's Peacemakers by Bertram Levine and Grande Lum, I think I'm saying those names correctly, has all the receipts. It basically says there was a department, a secret government department, that just in case anything went wrong, made absolutely sure that the narrative was set and that events went the way that the planners wanted it to. Honestly, this is, like I said, it's mind-blowing that what this book reveals. So I'm going to get into some of the things that they've been involved with soon. But first, I think it's worth setting a bit of context. Who was it that was involved in this specifically? Well, in the years before LBJ, that is Lyndon B. Johnson, signed the Civil Rights Act in 1964, they needed to manufacture consent. Now, if you remember, there was the Brown versus Board of Education case back in the 1950s, and this was used to build the momentum for the eventual signing of the Civil Rights Act by Johnson. However, these were not organic or spontaneous events. They were carefully planned. And I'm going to go through some of the people who actually did it. The department I'm talking about was created under Title 10 of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. There's Johnson with Martin Luther King Jr. behind him, and is known as CRS, a peacemaker. And that is what this book is about. America's Peacemakers basically spills the beans on what the CRS has been up to for the past, since 1964. But it was actually created, or the plans to create this department predate the Civil Rights Act. And Lyndon B. Johnson, when he was the senator there in the 50s, was absolutely instrumental in bringing this about. And here are some of his co-conspirators. There's a man called Benjamin V. Cohen, who is known as the architect of the New Deal. He was also quite a major Zionist back in the day as well. So he's a pretty influential fellow, big in the FDR administration. So Cohen worked with Johnson to bring this about. Another man really instrumental was Arthur Goldberg, who sat on the US Supreme Court. He was part of the group that brought about the CRS. And finally, Arnold Aronson and Joseph Rohr, who were working with the NAACP. They were really part of the organized minority who brought the Civil Rights Act about, working with people like Martin Luther King Jr., Rosa Parks, you know, all of that stuff were really part of this group. And if you're interested, there, I found this article by Clay Risen in Tablet Magazine, written 11 years ago, essentially framing all of the stuff they did in a positive light. Okay. What I am really interested in here, not so much saying, well, civil rights good, civil rights bad. If you ask me, LBJ, one of the worst presidents. If you ask me, what we call woke today and the whole culture around that is directly downstream of the Civil Rights Act. You know, culture is downstream from law. But what interests me actually here is the mechanism, the lack of leaving things to chance, the lack of genuine spontaneity that this department, this CRS, has helped facilitate over the years and the decades. And it's still up and running today, the CRS. This screenshot I took is of a live stream on YouTube of people talking about exactly what it is they do at the CRS and basically boasting about their activities. It was really quite remarkable. So let's get into what it is that the CRS did, what it is that the CRS does. It's been described as a spontaneous protest machine. Like I said, it was created by Title 10 of the Civil Rights Act, originally drafted in the 50s by LBJ and this cast of characters that I just talked you through. And it was created strictly in a non-law enforcement capacity, a non-law enforcement agency is the words they use, tasked with keeping the peace, quote unquote. It was tasked with mediation and conciliation in all matters related specifically to race, racial relations in America. It was given no power to investigate, assign fault, or press charges. That's left up to the law enforcement agencies, FBI, and so on. Yet, the amount of power they still have, despite that, is pretty far-reaching under Title 10. In its public-facing media, CRS presents itself in this manner, as a kind of non-law enforcement agency. And its agents are called conciliators. All of this information, by the way, is from this book by Levine and Lum, which, it's not that difficult to get hold of. You can just get it on Amazon. It was published 5 years ago. And so let's get into some of the things that this department can do. The first thing to bear in mind is that it has a confidentiality claim on par with the FBI. That is why I'm calling it a secret agency in the title of this video, because virtually nothing its conciliators do is a public record. If you make a Freedom of Information request, you can only reveal basic information like travel receipts. Aside from all the official records kept for the DOJ and its internal reporting, all notes made by the conciliators are destroyed, and conciliators may invoke their confidentiality privilege before Congress and before the courts, and they have done so many times in the past. So if Congress wanted to haul up the CRS, they could say, look, actually, we've got a right not to tell you what we've been up to. So they're protected, under Title 10 of the Civil Rights Act. So they don't actually have to reveal information about what they've done. So that's a really important thing to understand, because there's a certain degree, there's a lack of transparency there as to what these guys have been up to. They are kind of spooks. They're like a nudge unit, basically, in this country, in Britain. Whenever something goes wrong, there are these people who kind of creep up and start whispering in the ears of victims and so on. This is a nudge unit, disaster response unit, whatever they call it. Well, in America, this CRS, as long as it's pertaining to something to do with civil rights, that is race, and now gender, sexuality, anything to do with the Alphabet Spaghetti Committee, basically, and the CRS will be on the scene. Okay, now this actually works both ways, and it gets pretty dark. So let's carry on here. Another thing to understand about them is that, again, by law, by Title 10 of the Civil Rights Act, they are self-consciously a pro-civil rights organization. They don't pretend to be impartial. They are for this. They are set up to enforce civil rights morality. So when people like Curtis Yarvin talk about the civil rights regime and about the rewriting of the American Constitution by the Civil Rights Act, it's stuff like this, really, that he may well be talking about. The CRS only acts in the interests of advancing the civil rights movement. So that's black representation, transgender youth visibility, construction of mosques. For example, they, in one case, they helped to construct a mosque in the middle of an all-Christian town. They started initially as a strictly racial organization, but under Obama, there was a anti-crime legislation. And it's funny, I've been writing a speech recently in a conference I'm going to. So I was actually, when this guy sent me this book, I was already looking into what changed, because my paper's about how woke is downstream of law. And I was saying, well, in this country, it's pretty obvious. The Equality Act 2010 basically set in stone what became woke, and culture then caught up with the law. I was like, in America, they've had civil rights on the books for a long time. So what happened? Well, in 2009, Obama had something called the Anti-Hate Crime Bill. It's got some, it's the name of two senators, but it's known as the Anti-Hate Crime Bill. And that was established in 2009. So really, if you think, well, from that moment on, woke goes into overdrive. And that's because that bill expanded the remit of civil rights into all of these other areas. It's basically the American equivalent of the Equality Act 2010. In this country, we also had anti-discrimination laws on the books, but the Equality Act not only unified them all, but expanded them all. And this bit of Obama legislation in 2009 did the same thing. And notably, Mitch McConnell and friends didn't block it, right? Mitch McConnell was known for blocking everything Obama tried to do. Didn't block that one, notably. So the CRS's scope covers religion in theory, on paper, but in practice, it only intervenes on behalf of religious groups with a visible racial minority. For example, the Arab American community. I did a bit of snooping on what like the CRS have been up to recently, and there's a ton of stuff about like Arab American visibility, building mosques and things like that, which is really, really quite remarkable to think that a federal government agency is doing all of this sort of thing. So in this book, Bertram Levine, who's one of the authors, admitted what the true purpose of it was. Basically, they wanted to prevent what they call, and this is a direct quote, white backlash to the Civil Rights Act. Okay, and this is talked about in the introduction of this book by Levine and Lum. Immediately after its creation, the CRS began working with groups like the Southern Christian Leadership Conference to harass so-called, again, this is a direct quote, lily white towns, organizing and executing large-scale demonstrations by coordinating with local law enforcement. And again, this is something I've looked at in the past. I always found it really strange that in all these all-white towns in Georgia, people like Oprah Winfrey were sending people down there to harass the locals. And, you know, they were basically bussing in protesters in these quote-unquote racist towns. And I always thought that was a really odd thing. And this explains the mechanism behind it. It was the CRS who were doing that. Without all of this, the aggressive project of forced integration in both the South and the North would have been impossible. For example, CRS agents were directly involved in the forced integration of Catholic communities in Boston in the 1970s. Whenever a white student was violently assaulted, For example, there was a 17-year-old called Michael Faith in the mid-70s who was assaulted. The CRS agents would be on the scene immediately, not to provide physical aid to the injured student, but to prevent the white students from fighting back. Again, direct quote from Levine and Lum, page 193. The early work of the CRS included PR and media campaigns, such as managing the Selma protest, Martin Luther King protest in Selma, the Poor People's Campaign, and various others. During the late 1960s and early 1970s, the CRS built their modern playbook for managing minority political causes in the service of the regime, particularly in the realm of advertising, media, and news. All that Edward Bernays stuff I've been talking about, it's all in here, and it's not even being done by the likes of Bernays. It's being done by the federal government, by this specific agency. And they've written a book boasting about it, telling you, giving you the receipts. And it would be an interesting exercise to pick up that book and put it together with Who Paid the Piper to see, well, okay, Who Paid the Piper looks at all the other areas. You put it together with this, and it's like, well, did anything happen in after World War II in America that was organic? Or was it all these various spooks? The development of this playbook was complemented by the CRS's highly competent early leadership, which included soft power specialists like Leroy Collins, the former president of the National Association of Broadcasters, and Roger Wilkins, who is the former special assistant of USAID. What the CRS liked to do was threaten local news stations with the revocation of the FCC license. So they basically go in, they'd say, look, if you don't comply with what we're asking you to do, you're going to lose your broadcasting license. So you better do as we say. Direct threat. If, and here it comes, they did not immediately hire black news anchors. This was part of their initiative to, quote, drive Jim Crow out of journalism. Direct quote, Levine and Lum. Another campaign was the creation of propaganda films starring big names like Bill Cosby. These films, such as the Mercer Project, I haven't seen it, I'm afraid, were designed to allow blacks to integrate smoothly into previously whites-only spaces. This is basically what I would call Fresh Prince in embryo. You know, Bill Cosby was the original Fresh Prince, if you want to put it that way. Another key aspect of the CRS's work was corralling and controlling black protests and riots. And this I found really fascinating, because if you remember during BLM, a lot of people were saying, well, this is a revolution. And I was saying, it's not a revolution at all. This is a counter-revolution. And BLM are the foot soldiers, the stormtroopers of the regime. And if you remember that closely, there was actually evidence of people laying stuff on. Truckloads of brick pallets laid on, corporate-made signs, all sorts of signs that there is a centrally planned AstroTurf. And then other things. I remember people at the time pointing out, well, hold on a second, why is the police not responding as they usually would? Why is New York State putting BLM on the streets? This is not an actual protest. This is an AstroTurfed, pretty much state-sponsored protest. It's not a quote-unquote protest. Like I said, Greta Thunberg's all the way down. Anyway, so, corralling and controlling black protests and riots. This has been part of the CRS's mission from the very beginning. For example, in 1965, they worked with militant black leaders like Reverend Franklin Florence, who was a student of Saul Alinsky, of Rules for Radicals fame, as part of a summer project. The CRS's job with black militants during the summer project was twofold. One, to keep the black riots from overly angering the white urban population, and two, to prevent the nascent black separatist movement from gaining control of black opinion in America. And this is something else I've talked about before, and something that the black community, especially in rap songs and things in the 90s, were always talking about. That basically, there's a kind of spook element here where it has to be Martin Luther King. It cannot be Malcolm X. And I mean, if you have a look, I remember looking years ago at FBI tactics of infiltrating and shutting down black separatist movements. The playbook was developed against the likes of Malcolm X. So, and here it is from the horse's mouth. This book is really remarkable. It really is. Using a combination of propaganda, political maneuvering, cooperation with law enforcement, the CRS prevented white America from becoming enraged when black rioters destroyed multiple American cities during the summers of 1967 and 1972. They set up something called rumor control, an information warfare operation, and they continue to use that to this day. So there's actually a project sponsored by the federal government called rumor control. This is a method of capturing and debunking claims that are harmful to the regime. You're all familiar with fact-checking operations, well, rumor control. In this case, rumor control was used to control local news media, downplaying the damage of the riots and amplifying excuses by civil rights leaders, explaining that riots were, quote, mere violent outbursts resulting from black oppression. And again, we saw this exact playbook during BLM. Only it was so extreme during BLM that a lot of people ended up just laughing at them because it was so ridiculous. You know, the guy with the CNN camera saying like, oh, you're mainly peaceful protests and, you know, the city's on fire behind him. We lived through it. I remember it. The difference now, of course, as opposed to back in the 60s, is that everybody's got a camera. Everybody's got a pocket phone. So these tactics, I think, don't work as well as they used to. Although, from any objective standard, I think BLM was a pretty good psyop, to be honest. CRS, at the same time, used similar tactics to discredit radical black separatists who advocated for blacks to check out from American society and set up their own nation. This prevented blacks from becoming, on the one hand, too violent, which would cause white anger, and on the other, disinterested in racial integration and civil rights struggle, leading to black separatism. So they deliberately, they're constantly trying to do two things. They're constantly trying to simmer down any white outrage or white backlash or white anger, and at the same time, stop the black community from getting too violent or from wanting to go their own way. The Malcolm X. From these experiences handling riots in the late 1960s and the 1970s, they developed a basic playbook through trial and error that has been used in the astroturfing of Black Lives Matter and many other civil rights movements. CRS prefers to corral black riots into optical, palatable movements which are acceptable to the media and the public. For example, they were responsible for stage managing the entire Trayvon Martin affair from the beginning, parading the Martin family in front of Congress, carefully managing protests in Sanford, Florida, training activists, astroturfing leftist organizations like the Dream Defenders to create a perfect media spectacle. And again, this is all outlined in the Levine and Lund book. They're like a whole chapter just on that. And they're kind of boasting about it. This is the crazy thing. They're like, oh, look at the great thing that we did. It must be emphasized that neither the civil rights movement nor Black Lives Matter would have even been remotely influential without the CRS carefully handling every aspect of logistics and PR. The CRS trains left-wing activists through a program called Marshall Training, buys and coordinates supplies like water and jumbotrons, works with local law enforcement, establishes protest march routes, ensures media coverage, is kind of seeing the right people marching, all of the optics. And we've done so many streams on this. I remember with Pharaoh, we did a whole stream on how to spot an astroturfed march. And this is why this book is so mind-blowing, because it basically says, like, yeah, this is the playbook. Yeah, we have been doing this. Yeah, you guys were absolutely right. CRS has used this playbook to manage an astroturf spontaneous protest all over America, supporting a vast array of leftist political causes like BLM and Pride events in small conservative towns, North Carolina being one example, protests against Columbus Day in Colorado, counter demonstrations to the KKK in Ohio. And then this is where it starts getting pretty dark, because that's all of the, you know, the protest side. But then they also work in downplaying and covering up, you could say, violent acts and even murder. And this is, you know, probably been the best known thing, because as I was looking into this, I found an article by Raw Red Nationalist, who's a buddy of mine. I haven't talked to him about this, but there was a guy called Donald Giusti, who was from Lewiston, Maine. And if you have a look at this headline here, you'd think that, you know, this was kind of a tussle he got into and then he died of his injuries. Actually, this was a brutal murder by Somalians, I believe. The CRS kicked into action, and, you know, they downplayed any of the racial elements. They made sure the local news reported it in this very neutral way that would prevent outrage. It would prevent any backlash from the local population. And more importantly, it would prevent people clamoring against the mass importations of Somalis to this area. So, and basically what happened is that, just like Levine and Lum wrote this book, they've now kind of spilled the beans on all of these sorts of things as well. So, you know, they've in it, and they maybe never thought that people like us would read these books. You know, if they did think that, why make it all public? I have no idea why they released this information. They got sloppy, I guess, or they got kind of complacent or arrogant. There's a decent piece by Raw Egg Nationalist talking exactly about how basically racially motivated murders have been downplayed, you know, by the CRS for their own political end. So, yeah, I mean, bottom line here is that, you know, Trump is the president at the moment, and if they really want to change the direction America's been heading in, while they're in charge right now, while they control Congress, while they control the DOJ, okay, they could shut all this down. They could feasibly do something about this. Right? They could if they wanted to help their base, if they wanted to prevent injustices like the ones we've been talking about happening again and again, or, you know, the travesty of BLM, which basically wrecked the end of Trump's first presidency, or it was COVID, it was that, it was what happened in the Biden election. But if they want to prevent all of these things, they have to start targeting things like this. You know, okay, they ripped up USAID and DOGE and all of that, so, you know, these are positive steps, but this would really be a kind of, you know, talk about culture war victories, this would be a big one. And since the information is out there now in this book that somebody handed to me, you know, it'd be a really big opportunity to do something about it. So, yeah, I thought this was tremendously interesting. Grateful for the chap who passed this along to me. And, let me know what you think. If you know of any other things that the CRS have done, you know, now's the time to talk about it. And I think that maybe a bigger conversation needs to happen about this. from my point of view, from like an academic point of view, this has got all the receipt. This is like another one of those books like Who Paid the Piper, where I'm just like, wow, it's even less organic, even less is less up to chance than you'd think. If you'd have told me this stuff like 10 years ago, I'd have called you a raving nutter. There it is, written by the people who did it. So anyway, pick up a course at the Academic Agency, the Trivium, buy it now. Foundations of Shakespeare as well, of course. And yeah, I'll see you next time. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.